I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're going to start off with two shorter stories at the intersection of religion and politics, one about a congressional race down in Texas, and the other involving LDS women appealing to the four Mormon members of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
We'll also introduce a new segment we call Race to the Bottom, in which we discuss the latest ridiculousness from conservative white evangelicals. And then Amy has a conversation with writer Daniel Mayfield about religion and ethics on NBC's The Good Place and about the late Mr. Rogers.
We're able to keep this podcast going thanks to the generous backing of individuals like you who support us every month. If you like what you hear, you too can become a sponsor of Impolite Company. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. We're halfway to our goal and are so grateful to those of you who have already become patrons for as little as $1 a month.
This week, we're going to start in Houston, Texas, where a once solidly Republican congressional seat is potentially up for grabs thanks to demographic changes and an innovative Democratic candidate. Last week, we spoke about good and bad ways to engage in faith outreach to voters, and, well, this is an example of a very bad way to do that.
We hope to bring you an interview with the Democratic candidate in this race, Sri Kulkarni, in the coming weeks. But for now, it's important to know that this district in the Houston-Fort Bend area is one of the most ethnically diverse in Texas. It's seen a lot of immigration in over the past decade. One quarter of the residents are foreign-born, which is the second highest percentage in the state, and nearly 20% of the district is Asian. Kulkarni, a Houston native whose father is of Indian descent, has been focusing his efforts on first-time voters, especially in this large Asian community. So apparently local Republicans thought they'd try as well. Bad idea genes, as we say in our house.
Yikes. The Fort Bend Republican Party ran an ad earlier this month in a local paper called the India Herald. We'll post a photo on our Facebook page because you really have to see it to believe it.
It's so bad.
It's so bad. The ad was placed in time for the Hindu celebration Ganesh Chaturthi, and it features a large depiction of the elephant-headed deity Ganesh. So far, okay. But at the bottom of the ad are the words, "Would you worship a donkey or an elephant? The choice is yours." So bad. The apparent attempt was to compare the Republican Party's elephant symbol to the Hindu Lord Ganesh. Fort Bend Republicans have since apologized for the ad. Yeah, I bet they have.
Oh, Nish.
Oh. It's... really?
Yeah. Well,
like the level of stupidity is just, I mean, I guess 2 points for trying, but like, holy cow. Did you have to be so offensive about it?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. There were a number of places where they went wrong on this.
It's
not surprising. Yeah. One of the local Hindu American board members, I think, Hindu American Foundation, called it problematic and offensive. He said that it should probably be best avoided by any political party. And among other things, one problem that comes up, particularly for Hindu kids in public schools in some places in the country, is the misconception that Hindus actually worship animals. So because of not eating beef and because of respecting and honoring the cow, often that gets turned into, you know, you worship a cow. So that's slightly problematic already. And to turn that into, do you want to worship an elephant, just kind of extends the problem. I have to say, just to jump in here, that I think it's equally bad, and I've seen this a lot more often because this seems to be a first for using Ganesh in a political ad, at least in American politics, and doing it badly. But I've seen more often things like Jesus rode a donkey from religious progressives trying to argue that, you know, and as you know, we make the argument as well that a lot of Jesus's, say, comments about the poor might fit in with one certain party's platform and policies a little better than another's. But to put it as baldly as Jesus rode a donkey, so you should vote for the party that has a donkey as the symbol, is just kind of gross.
I remember seeing an image. It was a political image, and it was from Democrats, actually, which it was a long time ago, but it was, you know, an image of an elephant that, like, again, the layers of offense and disgustingness go really deep here, but it had its tusks cut off and, like, on the ground, and it said, and it had, like, Psalm 75:10 that says, "And all the horns of the wicked I will cut off." Like, it was, oh gosh, it was so offensive. It was so terrible. I'm like, wow, can we not, can we not on several levels? And this, like, has that sort of just very deeply offensive, like, can we not use very holy, very sacred symbols and very, that which may involve animals in whatever way for different religious traditions? Can we not use what is sacred for something so blatantly, like, partisan, political? I don't want to say political, but partisan, because I do think that politics, obviously, and religion have very deep connections, but it's just gross. It's just, ugh, I don't know. It's so offensive. It's just so offensive on a whole lot of levels.
Yeah. You know, I can, not to play too much of a devil's advocate here, but I can kind of see why the local Republican Party thought that this could be an area that might work for them. Just in that, and during the 2016 presidential campaign, there was fairly public support for Trump from some Hindu Americans. And I'm thinking here, there was a rally that took place, I want to say in October. I remember being up editing the piece that was written by one of our reporters who covered it. And it was really something. I can guarantee you have never seen anything quite like this. For about 2 hours before Trump even appeared, there were lots of Bollywood dances going on. It was very much like a cultural festival. In fact, most people who were there seemed to be not aware that Trump was going to be part of it and a little annoyed when they found out. But the guy who helped organize it, who is an Indian American leader, quite wealthy guy, one of Trump's biggest fundraisers, gave him basically this platform to talk about Hindus and Americans being best friends. And he got a lot of things wrong, of course, because this is Donald Trump. And he basically implied that all Indians are Hindu. And wow, there have been a lot of civil wars fought over this very question. But, you know, the end result was that he actually did get a small bit of support from Hindu Americans. That said, that doesn't mean you can just, like, stampede into this area and not be thinking straight about what you do in terms of appeals.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, best to not do anything.
Right.
Like, because now they've had to apologize.
Right. Like, it's as much as Amy and I are going to advocate for faith outreach amongst the Democratic Party specifically, but we just think faith outreach in general is a good idea. This is also our plea. Be smart. Don't be stupid. If you don't know, then don't do it. At the very least, ask. Like, just ask. Approach a religious group in your area that represents that particular faith tradition and run it by them in good faith.
Well, they do say that it was created with input from those of the Hindu faith. And I'm sure that getting the, say, the image of Ganesh, which was used there, was done with some input. I'm betting they didn't run that little tagline.
That's right.
Past anybody who was Hindu.
Right. That's exactly right.
Or they might not have ended up with that.
Yeah. Just be smart. Think through it. Ask first. That is our plea. Be smart. Think through it. And ask
Words
first.
To live by from right. Nish. Yes.
There you go. Wisdom of the day.
Well, we will move on because our second quick hit comes from the Mormon Women for Ethical Government, which is a nonpartisan group of more than 6,000 women who are active LDS members, although their group is not officially affiliated with the LDS Church. These women issued a public statement at the beginning of this week directed at the four Mormon senators who sit on the Judiciary Committee. That's Senators Hatch, Lee, Flake, and one of Nish's senators, Mike Rappo.
Mm-hmm. And two of my former senators, actually, Hatch and
right.
Oh, just hitting them all today. They specifically call upon these men to ensure that charges against Brett Kavanaugh are taken seriously and investigated fully. I'm going to read two portions of their statement here. Quote, our mutual faith teaches that any sexual abuse or assault in any context is contemptible and worthy of the most severe condemnation. And, quote, we boldly condemn any attempts to justify such inexcusable and reprehensible behavior and demand that our elected leaders set a morally sound example, unquote. Well, good job, Mormon women. I have to say, I am quite impressed, especially since Mormon women's support of Donald Trump was less than white evangelical women, but not by much.
It's still high. Yeah.
It's still super high. Next to white conservative evangelicals, Mormons were pretty high up on, you know, the groups who supported Donald Trump, who supported his candidacy, even after it came out that, you know, well, those, the Access Hollywood tapes came out. Support for him waned a little bit, but not enough to make a difference. I mean, he still won Utah. So, and that was with Evan McMullen running,
right?
If you guys remember Evan McMullen, the third party candidate who was LDS himself. Mormons still voted for Donald Trump in favor. So yeah, I'm impressed. I'm encouraged, frankly, by this, to see this kind of, I don't want to call it a turn of events. I wouldn't go that far, but to see a group of, you know, faithful, traditionally conservative women come up and say, like, hey, this has to stop. Like, you have to investigate. It's worth the pause to, you know, to all of this and say, like, no, this deserves a level of seriousness. So I think it's good. It's great.
Yeah. It remains to be seen whether somebody like, say, Orrin Hatch will pay any attention. You know, he has been out there not mincing words. And here I can't help but flashback to the Clarence Thomas hearings, because he was awful. Also awful. Yeah. He was also pretty awful to Anita Hill. And once again, this time he's referring to accusations as phony. He is one of the people really trying to push this through as quickly as possible. And this is where it kills me that things like this happen in our politics, because the point, I assume, from congressional Republicans who want to just get the vote over with, is to get Kavanaugh locked in his Supreme Court seat for life, so that whatever other accusations come up, they can't hurt him. But that's insane.
Yeah.
Like, it is, it's truly insane. It's not saying, like, because there's no recourse. Anything could come up after they vote on him or anybody. And in this case, there just seems to be good reason to think that the more people who come out, the more likely other folks who'd been kind of waiting and understandably not wanting to put themselves out there,
yep,
would feel more comfortable saying something.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a bizarre way that we go about this, that, you know, you try to lock somebody in so that they're safe for life.
Yep. Yeah. And it's worth kind of giving a little bit of context to this particular group, and also what's happening in the LDS Church at large in regards to sexual assault allegations and some things that have come out over the last few years. There have been allegations of sexual assault happening in like the LDS missionary training centers. There have been accusations that the hierarchy and the leadership of the church actually took steps to cover up those things. The Salt Lake Tribune actually won a Pulitzer for its reporting of campus rape and assault that happened at BYU. There's a lot of contextual things that are happening around sexual assault, rape, and these sorts of allegations in the LDS context. So this is a talked about topic amongst the LDS faithful, even today, like right now. There are cases being put forward. There are allegations being made. The church is kind of embattled in its own allegations. So in some ways, this obviously is very political in its nature with it being a Supreme Court nomination, in some ways, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that this particular group of, you know, Women for Ethical Leadership are coming forward and saying, you know, this needs to be fully investigated and taken seriously. It in some ways feels a little bit like a shot over the bow to the LDS church as a whole, for these women to come out in a political context to say like this, like sexual assault allegations of all kind needs to be taken seriously, and they need to be investigated, feels a little bit like, you know, a kind of holler over the shoulder to the LDS church to say, yeah, do you hear that? Like sexual assault allegations need to be taken seriously and cover-ups need to be taken seriously and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in regards to just the whole picture of the LDS church and how it's dealing with sexual assault, this doesn't seem like a surprising thing, as encouraging as it is. I think it's kind of on par with what's happening in the church as a whole.
That's really good context to have. And we might also note that Orrin Hatch, this is his swan song. He is retiring at the end of this year. Interesting that this is the way he would want to go out. Mm-hmm. It's always been, it's been astonishing to me that he has a reputation of being kind of a statesman. And he is one of the elder members of the caucus, but he's always been willing to mouth off. Mm-hmm. And he's had kind of a short temper. Like before even any of these accusations came up, he was mad that Democrats wanted to actually see maybe some of the documents from Kavanaugh's time in the Bush administration. And he, what did he say here? We can't keep going down this partisan, picky, stupid, dumbass road that has happened around here for so long. I am sick and tired of it, to be honest with you, and I'm tired of the partisanship. Well, time for you to go fishing, Orrin.
It's just this guy.
Like, get off my lawn.
Yeah, you know what? I will say that it is, let me say this. Mitt Romney's silence on this issue is deafening. Mm-hmm. The guy who wants to take Orrin Hatch's Senate seat. I am actually really curious about if he has anything to say about this situation, because he really could play this two ways. He could, you know, kind of take the current GOP hardline of, you know, this is a smear. This is, you know, these are allegations from 40 years ago. They're not relevant. It's uncorroborated, whatever, whatever, whatever. Or he could come out and say, hey, this is worth investigating and every sexual assault allegation should be taken seriously. And yet he has said nothing.
Profile and courage. Willard Mitt Romney.
Yeah, you know what? He's this guy. This freaking guy. We all know how I feel about Mitt Romney. Utah's next senator. That's neither here nor there. Anyway, okay, that actually brings us to our next topic. Well, it's kind of the same topic, but we're going to keep moving on. Since our last episode, several new accusers have come forward with questions about Brett Kavanaugh's character and accusations of inappropriate behavior. He and Professor Christine Blasey are scheduled to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee this Thursday, which it was originally scheduled for Monday. Blasey Ford came forward and said, you know, she needs more time, which is totally reasonable given the circumstances. And so agreement has been met. And they're going to have the hearing on Thursday.
It will not shock listeners to learn that, like other conservative figures, some evangelical leaders have had things to say about Kavanaugh's accusers, as well as about the seriousness of sexual assault in general. And that made us think this was a good time to introduce our new segment, Race to the Bottom. One concern that Nish and I both had for the second season of this show was one that mainstream outlets also deal with in covering Trump every day, which is, how do you make sure outlandish statements and actions don't go unchallenged while also not letting them drive the conversation?
So here's our imperfect solution. It is to bundle them into one segment and then just clear the air. So we're not going to give it a ton of oxygen. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. But first up this week is one of our favorites, Franklin Graham, who told an interviewer from the Christian Broadcasting Network that sexual assault accusations against Kavanaugh are, quote, not relevant, unquote. Okay, that's quote number one, that because it happened 40 years ago, that someone can bring up something he did when he was a teenager close to 40 years ago, that's not relevant. That's what he said. This freaking guy. Okay. And then the second thing he says is that, well, there wasn't a crime that was committed. Because in his mind, he said that, well, she said no, and he respected it and walked away. That's a direct quote from Franklin Graham about the situation, that it's actually not a crime because she said no and he walked away. So him putting her hands on her, his hand over her mouth, closing the door, all of those things do not amount to sexual assault.
Actually assaulting her, which is part of what he did. He didn't rape her. But if we're talking anything short of rape is not a crime, then he needs to consult with some criminal justice experts.
Yes.
Or really anybody.
Right. Yeah. I mean, literally anybody. Maybe not some of the other guys in our lineup, but definitely anybody else. Oh, this guy, it's really hard to determine who's going to be the worst here. Amy, who is your contender, another contender this week?
Oh, Nish. Well, one of my contenders is Eric Metaxas. And this quote of his, well, several quotes actually come from August, so that was a while ago, I know, but it's never too late for a good Metaxas slagging. So we had to bring him back. And this has to do with the White House dinner. Some people were calling it a state dinner for evangelicals that took place back at the end of August. And there was a who's who of white conservative evangelicals. So not a very broad group there.
Very but, narrow.
Yeah. Among them was our pal and yours, Eric Metaxas, national radio host who has, he has blocked half of religious progressivism, if that's even a thing. So I have found him through, I have my ways, Eric. He's blocked me and my regular account, but I can track him now. So I noticed a selfie that he posted on his Twitter page of him standing next to Trump. And here's his comment on the photo. Is that a sly smile or a scowl? I slipped him a crisp 20 when I asked if he might invite me back sometime. Was that vulgar? Should have been more? We'll discuss on today's Eric Metaxas show. Which just the guy.
This guy.
But, yes. Then, not surprisingly, he got a little bit of pushback for showing up to this event. And, maybe he should have used this opportunity since he says that he is not a supporter of absolutely everything Trump does. Maybe he should have used this opportunity to speak some truth to power. And apparently on his radio show the next day, he said that if he could talk to Trump, and I love that, if he could talk to the guy he took a picture standing right next to, he would be, quote, compelled to speak truth to power. So basically he means the next time he stands next to Trump, he would feel compelled to speak truth to power. Although that is called into question a bit by the fact that Eric also made news last month as the author of a newly released children's book called, and I quote, Donald Drains the Swamp. And you cannot make this up.
This freaking guy. I feel actually quite proud that I finally got blocked by him on Twitter.
And I am shocked that I got blocked before you did.
You did. And I didn't even go that hard at him, frankly. Like, he said something about he doesn't think that the policies of the Trump administration are harmful towards individuals. And so I just simply retweeted him and said, hey, raise your hand if you or someone you know has been personally harmed by a policy put into action by the Trump administration, with a little emoji with the hand raised, you know? And then he blocked me.
Eric will abide, no pushback.
I was like, aw, Eric, did I hurt your feelings? Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. So I'm just going to add on to the end of this little slag of Eric for his moral courage. Another white male evangelical conservative as well, Rob Schenck, who we've talked about on the pod before, who we need to have on, who posted his own photo on Twitter, not from that dinner, because I don't think he was invited to the dinner, but he was at something with Mike Pence a couple weeks ago. And he said, I renewed my appeal to Mike Pence to, quote, find your conscience. And he said to me, quote, it's always easier said than done. Which, come on, dude. You're right in the middle there. It's easier said than done to speak up against separating children from their parents, to speak up against a guy who can't go a day without offending people in some just incredibly insulting way. Like, if you're going to be in the middle there, and if you're going to tell people that you are there to do good and to try to stop Trump from doing bad, then you got to follow your conscience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This,
when do you find it then?
Right.
So anyway, Eric Metaxas, boo to you. What do you have?
Okay.
Next, Nish.
Our final entry in the race to the bottom is conservative commentator and blogger Eric Erickson. On Twitter 2 days ago, Erickson tweeted, I got to think there are a lot of suburban mothers horrified that one day their innocent son could be accused and presumed guilty of false claims. This is in reference to the Kavanaugh nomination and accusations coming against him for sexual assault.
Because, yes, definitely the response of most women has been to say, oh, my goodness, my sons.
Oh, the son. Who's going to think of the sons who... only 2-8% of accusations that come forward are false reporters. Anyway, we can go on and on and on. Anyway, I have to say, because I am back on Twitter, I have the wonderful privilege and ability to be able to clap back. And so I said, small town Idaho mom here, and I'm horrified that one day my daughter could be sexually assaulted and nobody would believe her. So you know what, Eric Erickson? Yeah, you know what? You can be afraid. You can be afraid all you want for your son that maybe one day he'll get falsely accused. But you know what? I'm way more concerned and fearful because the numbers make more sense. Just based on factual evidence, you should be way more concerned, Eric Erickson, that our daughters could be sexually assaulted and that people will not believe her. That is a way more likely scenario than a son getting accused falsely. It's just the facts. But I know facts are really hard. They're just really, really hard. And it's just, why? Why are facts so hard? Why, Amy?
It's just so interesting to me that what so horrifies guys like Erickson is the possibility that something that is already happening to women could happen to men.
Right.
Like, people already don't believe women.
Right.
But the only way he can wrap his head around it is to, you know, have his mind boggled at how unjust it would be if people didn't believe men about sexual incidents.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that. What would that be like? As every woman in America rolls her eyes. Okay, that is our segment to Race for the Bottom. Please let us know on Twitter, on Facebook, what you think. Who is the winner for this week's Race to the Bottom? Is it Franklin Graham? Is it Eric Metaxas? Or is it Eric Erickson? We would love to hear.
So tough to choose.
It's just, you know, terrible, awful, or atrocious. Those are your options.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Exactly right.
Not that actually, that's probably libeling Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
I don't know that that's quite the analogy that I would use.
I'm just making them their own biblical trio.
Very unbiblical trio. That's what we'll call them. The unbiblical trio. Love it.
Okay. For our final topic, I spoke with Danielle Mayfield, a writer and evangelical based in Portland, Oregon. Danielle has written a beautiful book about her upbringing and more recent work with refugee communities called Assimilate or Go Home: Notes from a Failed Missionary on Rediscovering Faith. And she sometimes gets to dig into slightly less weighty subjects like television and movies.
When Amy and I first talked about starting Impolite Company, we wanted to be able to talk occasionally about pop culture. Of course, that was when we thought Game of Thrones would be back within months instead of years, and it was before we fully realized how many horrible political stories would crowd the agenda every week. But with the third season of The Good Place returning this week, we thought it would be good to hear from Danielle on the show that she says revolves around some very Christian moral questions. Who is our neighbor, and what do we owe them?
One of our favorite shows is coming back this week, The Good Place. And I wanted to have you on to talk about it because you wrote a great piece about it for the webzine Christ in Pop Culture. The show is just like drenched in questions of morality and ethics. And even although they don't intend it necessarily to be about any one religious system, a lot of religious questions too. Can you just tell a little bit about first starting to watch the show, if you started from the very beginning, and kind of what your thoughts were on encountering it?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. And I am so excited The Good Place is coming back. I really don't think there's a show like it on television because it is, you know, a half hour comedy. It's really funny. The actors are amazing. And it's a show dealing with moral philosophy and the ethical questions of how we live our lives and how connected we are to each other. Like, that's incredible, you know? And it's on just NBC, just a network show. So anybody could watch this anywhere. And I think it's incredibly accessible. While at the same time, if you dive deep into some of the themes of the show, you can go down some rabbit holes. Like, I ended up like checking some books out from the library. Peter Singer, his books and articles on affluence and ethics. Like, it really launched me into some fascinating places, which I was not expecting from an NBC comedy with Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. So it's really, really complex, honestly. And I am coming from an evangelical Christian background. And like many people, I'm in my mid-30s, and I've been doing some deconstruction work for a while, partly triggered by the political climate, which has forced me and many other people to say, wait a minute, what are our values here? What are our ethics in regards to what we owe our neighbors, particularly our neighbors that are possibly the most vulnerable in our society? I just don't really see a lot of that ethic coming into play. And so it's interesting. The Good Place is not about religion, and yet I see so much of basically how Jesus summed up the scripture, which is love God and love your neighbor. I see it's particularly that second commandment all over The Good Place, and it really makes me think. And I think it makes a lot of other people think too.
Yeah, it is interesting that you point out the show is airing, and I think was created before the 2016 election. So it wasn't necessarily a response to the Trump administration, but it is airing at a time when the leadership and the church community that you and I both grew up in, which insisted that moral relativism was just this awful thing that liberals subscribed to. They're the ones making morally relativistic arguments and saying more often things like, well, you know, who can know? Things aren't altogether bad or altogether good. And, you know, the Bible's kind of vague about what our obligations to each other are. And, you know, even if we do bad things, what does it really matter? And then here's this show that does kind of dive in particularly to that question, because we've got a bunch of people who have ended up in what we learn is the bad place. And they're not murderers. We're not trying to adjudicate whether people who have done horrendous things are irredeemable. But through their lives, they've done an accumulated number of not awesome things and are then left to figure out if somebody can really change.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the central premise of the show, is that people can change. They can learn to love their neighbor. They can learn to realize that their actions have consequences on other people. And actually, what's fascinating is now we're, the show is kind of showing us that heavenly beings can also change. Demons can change. And it's so fascinating. And near the end of season two, Michael, who's kind of the head demon who ends up, you know, becoming aware and concerned with these four humans, he basically is telling the judge, who is Maya Rudolph and who's awesome, that if people can change, then the entire system of the good and bad place is essentially flawed. And I just thought that was such a fascinating way to sort of end the second season, because it really made me think about my own religious upbringing, particularly this emphasis on salvation being intellectual assent to Jesus. Basically, praying the sinner's prayer is the one thing you do that gets you into the good place. And everything else is just sort of, I don't know. We can think about that later. And that is actually incredibly damaging.
One of the things I was really interested that it got into again, and I'm sorry, people, if you haven't seen the show at all, maybe you should just fast forward here and go watch it. But at one point, Eleanor gets sent back to her old life, I believe, and is not aware of anything that had come before. But she starts to make different decisions, and yet pretty quickly learns that doing the right thing and trying to think of other people can sometimes be a drag. I love that they introduce that tension, because we see it all the time. I remember after Hurricane Katrina, there were all sorts of stories about people who had lost their homes and they were being taken in by good souls all over the country who, you know, said, we've got room in our house. You know, let's bring this family to come live with us. And at the beginning, those people who were opening their homes, like, it was this just big jolt of adrenaline. But then if you followed up some of those families living in close proximity with people they'd helped, turns out sometimes the people you help aren't 100% grateful, or they don't behave like you want them to behave, or being up close with them, you start to wonder if they are really deserving of your help, and it starts to break down. And that is kind of a central tension of the commandment to help others, to be your brother and sister's keepers without being their judge.
Oh, that's good. I like that line. Yeah, I think I never really heard the phrase, but in the Good Place episode all about that, they call it moral deserts. So doing something good in order, like you said, to be rewarded. And I definitely go through my life like that. And it just doesn't always work out. And so when something bad does happen to me, even though I've been trying very hard to be good, it actually can send me down this spiral of what's it all even for? And so I think this next season, they've made it pretty clear, is all going to be on Earth, which I think is going to be fascinating and probably even more applicable for those of us who are wanting to do good and recognizing that it's going to cost us a lot if we are going to live with our neighbors in mind. And I mean, I don't think there's a way to sugarcoat it, and I'm happy that they're not, and I'm looking forward to watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it may be the most uncomfortable of the seasons, precisely because it does get closer to where we are, as you say. It'll be fun to watch, but oh boy. So I'm going to ambush you here because I didn't tell you we were going to talk about this as well. But since I contacted you about chatting about The Good Place, I also read your review of the most recent Mr. Rogers biography.
Yeah.
And I was hoping if you, because there's some tension in there as well, that one of the things that you focus on in your review is how much Fred Rogers was driven by anger. And you can call it righteous anger, but it was not the emotion that we associate with him from his calm personality. Was that something that you anticipated before reading the biography? And what did you take away from that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The reason I think I've been so interested in Fred Rogers is the same reason why I love The Good Place, because both of them have these themes of what do we owe each other? How can we love our neighbor? What does a flourishing community look like where everybody is doing okay and not just one? So it's kind of anti-individualism, right? And so when I read this biography by Maxwell King of Fred Rogers, I was just so struck by how unique of a person he was, how much conflict he had in his life. Again, I think we think of him as a very gentle soul, but he was incredibly driven, incredibly rigid about his principles. And he was driven by this sense like, this is not okay, the way children are treated, the way they are pandered to. And also, I think media in general really made him upset. He saw such a potential for education. And instead, television became a tool for selling. And so he kind of spent his whole life trying to make a difference. And, you know, sometimes he really became despondent and felt like he had done nothing. And I think more people have probably seen the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, but it also talks about how he felt sometimes, what was this all for? I did nothing. You know, I tried so hard for so many years. And in the end, September 11th happened.
And Fox News is attacking him for supposedly fostering a whole generation of helpless kids because their parents are telling them they're good just as they are.
Yeah. And so he was called an evil person, and he created the self-entitled generation, and he got pushback from so many sides, actually. Some people thought he was too political. Others were very disappointed in him that he wasn't more overtly political about certain issues. And so I just was fascinated that he kept going, which I think is a fascinating thing. But it was helpful for me to understand the righteous anger that sort of drove him, and that he also suffered with wondering if he had done enough. And that was one of the most compelling parts of reading about him. He never lost that sense of urgency. And when I think about maybe growing up, the people I was taught were the most wise. They were all very calm. You know, they all accepted the world. Like, I thought that was what I was supposed to aspire to. And Fred Rogers, I don't think he ever accepted the world for as it was. I think he always knew that children were so inherently valuable. There was still so much work to be done in reaching them and telling them that. And I kind of want to keep that same drive within me to see the image of God in everyone. And I think there's a lot of ways the world tries to take that out of us.
That's definitely more the way you would describe Jesus, as somebody who had righteous anger and did not think we should accept the world as it is. And it definitely makes me want to read the book, because I felt a little disconnected from all the people I knew who watched the documentary and came out saying, oh my goodness, what a breath of fresh air. And I know what they were saying. I know that they meant, if only we had somebody like that speaking to us today. It was so nice to just be in a dark theater for an hour and a half, listening to Mr. Rogers. But I came out of the documentary just incredibly depressed and thinking how disappointed Mr. Rogers would be with us today. And kind of the same worry that he had of what is it all for? Because he had this wonderful ministry. And yet there is something about human nature that rebels against the teaching that he committed his life to and the teaching that many Christians commit their lives to.
Oh, yeah. And I actually was super depressed, too, when I watched the documentary. For a slightly different reason, mostly I was remembering what I learned in Sunday school, which is your heart is as black as a coal with sin, and God can't stand to look at you unless you've accepted Jesus into your heart. And so I was just sort of saying, wait a minute, Mr. Rogers is a Christian, I'm a Christian, and we have vastly different views on how to talk to children about their worth. Like, I really absorbed this narrative that God loved me, but also that there's something fundamentally wrong with me at the same time. And I think this is a juxtaposition within evangelicalism that we have not resolved. And I think, honestly, it impacts our politics. It impacts a whole lot of stuff. I was thinking about, there's this guy who's called the Donut Man. Did you ever watch him growing up? Okay, he was kind of a deal for evangelical Christians. And his whole thing was that life without Jesus is like a donut. You have a hole in the middle of your heart. And you would sing that every time you watched it. And like, so the whole premise of the show is like, little children have these huge gaping holes in their hearts until we ask Jesus into them. Yeah, so that's like the opposite of Mr. Rogers. So I grew up with the opposite of him. And so just thinking through how people of even the same religious traditions, we can have vastly different ways of even thinking through how people have the image of God in them. And I want to be more like Mr. Rogers. I really do.
We'll wrap up the show with our praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. Nish, what's going on with you this week?
Oh, what's going on with me? Well, you know, I'm just going to be like super cliche white girl and be like really excited about fall. I don't care about the pumpkin spice latte. They're not my favorite, but
thank you.
I'm just not a fan. I like my soy chai. If I want something that tastes like fall in a cup, it's going to be soy chai.
Have you had chider?
I had it once after you told me about it, and then I forgot about it, and now I'm going to go to Starbucks and order one.
It's fabulous.
I shouldn't say Starbucks. I need to go to my local little small town coffee shop and see if they have them.
Do you guys even have Starbucks up there?
We do. We have a Starbucks, but the only reason that it would be allowed to be in our tiny town here in Idaho was if it was inside the Albertsons and upstairs where people had to climb two flights of stairs to get to it.
All right.
The town was in an uproar when Starbucks was on the docket. Anyway, all that to say, I need to go get a chider, apparently. But I do. I mean, fall is here in full swing. It was 33 degrees when I woke up this morning.
Wow.
The high is in like the low 60s. I mean, it is just it's sunny every day, but it's still really cool. All of the aspens are starting to turn. So there's just these bright pockets of gold and yellow in the midst of these giant pine trees. It's just stunning. It's beautiful. I'm just reminded all over again that like fall in the mountains is just exquisite. And I'm so happy. I'm so happy that I can wear like leggings and sweatshirts again, which is like my favorite uniform as a work at home mom. So I'm really happy to be back in that attire. The other thing that I have to say is I am reading the memoir called Educated by Tara Westover. And it's about a girl who grew up in a survivalist family, actually in the backwoods of Idaho, not too far from where we live. And it's kind of her journey of getting out of that community and out of that situation where she grew up. And she like sneaks into classes at BYU. She ends up being, is it a grant scholar? I can't remember what it's called, to Cambridge. Just brilliant, brilliant story. Amazing woman, took a lot of bravery. Anyway, I'm in the middle of it, and it's such a captivating story. story. Like, there are times where I've literally gasped out loud reading her account of things that happened. It's just, I mean, just remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. I was just talking to my husband about it recently, because he's listening to the audiobook because he travels a ton in his car. And he, we were talking about the portion of the book where, I don't want to give the whole book away, it's remarkable, but she's sneaking into classes at BYU, and she comes across this picture, and she's like in an art history class or something. She comes across this photo, and underneath in the caption of the photo, she realizes like there's a word there that she can say, like she gets it, but she doesn't know what it means. And so she goes to her professor and she's like, what is this word and what does it mean? And the word is Holocaust. And like, she never learned about the Holocaust. She had no idea. Like, she just didn't know that it existed or that was a thing. Obviously something that like we're taught from a young age in world history, like we know about what happened. And she just literally in college had no idea that it was a part of world history. And so like you learn all of these things. Like, I can't imagine like not having any context for any sort of education or understanding about what has happened in the world, or what is happening in the world, or how politics work, or what democracy is. Like, none of that. She learns all of it as an adult. And ends up being, you know, this like brilliant scholar. And anyway, it's a fantastic book. It's a page turner. You won't put it down. You have to read it. It's so good. So that is what I am loving this week. Amy, what about you?
Well, we are not really feeling fall like you are. I think it's 80 degrees out today, but I love it as much as you do. So I'm eagerly awaiting cold temperatures. However, the nice part of that has been that we can eat outside, because right now we are in the middle of Sukkot, which is the Jewish holiday kind of around the harvest. It's more of kind of a folk holiday in Israel, and it's the one that Noam and his parents always celebrated the most. It's perhaps my kids' favorite of the Jewish holidays. And this year I got them together and we lobbied to demand a real sukkah, because I will not even, I won't complain about the just shoddy construction of sukkahs in the past that were based on like running over to Home Depot for 20 minutes the day of Sukkot or the first night of Sukkot and trying to like throw something up by like wrapping ropes around sink pedestals. It was abomination last year is what I'm saying. And this year, to his credit, it may have taken him a long time to put it together with the power tools, but Noam put up a very nice sukkah, and we can fit our new deck furniture under it. And we have been having dinner in the sukkah every night, and it is a delight.
So for our first time listeners, Amy, please, explain to people that you live or you are in a interfaith marriage, interfaith family.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
How that
well,
is.
Yes. We have an experiment that we are in the midst of that we will talk more about as the year goes on, whereby I am married to an unobservant Jew for whom the cultural aspects are very important. I am a practicing Baptist. The kids go to church with me. They go to the synagogue sometimes when I make them all for holiday observances. They went to a little kid Rosh Hashanah service a couple of weeks ago. And little Cormac, our four-year-old, is in preschool at the local synagogue this year for the first time ever. And I will say I was very worried about it, because he is so Jesus crazy.
He loves Jesus. That baby
I
loves
wanted
Jesus.
To figure out a way to tell him not to bring up Jesus that didn't involve letting him know that Jews don't believe in Jesus, because that would immediately make him like, I am not Jewish. But so far, it turns out he's just really into religion. So he has been demanding that we get challah every Friday and do Shabbat. And he has gotten totally into this. Yesterday, I just found these pictures lying around the house. He had drawn symbols of Rosh Hashanah, and there was Mr. Apple and Ms. Shofar.
Oh, gosh.
And I love that. In addition to it being fall, he has apparently choreographed a dance he calls Fall that involves him twirling and then falling to the ground like a leaf. And it is so sweet. So I am trying. He has not agreed to let me videotape it yet. But if I do, rest assured, I will share it because it will just bring joy and delight to your lives. In terms of a recommendation, I had heard that one of James Baldwin's novels was being made into a movie that comes out this fall. I'm very excited about it because Barry Jenkins, who made Moonlight.
Yes, is the director, isn't
it? Has made it. Yes.
Yeah.
But then I also read a recommendation to read the book before I saw the movie. And it is really powerful. It's a really, really good novel. It goes very quickly. And I would definitely recommend anybody who has interest in seeing the movie, read the book. And then you'll be ready when the movie comes out in November. And I am just going to use a point of personal privilege here since we do call this praises and petitions. My dad is having heart surgery next week and he would probably be a little annoyed with me for this, but I love him very much and we are a little tiny bit worried going into this. So I would appreciate prayers for Mr. Sullivan because he is an awesome guy and he has a huge heart. It just does not work the way that it should.
Aww. Yes, we're going to pray and send all of the good thoughts and positive vibes and anything that everyone likes to send to someone who is in distraught to Mr. Amy's dad. Okay, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!